On this week's 51%, a sports studies professor says the COVID-19 pandemic is costly for women's sports in particular. There's a study about support for transgender service members, and a teens nonprofit offering virtual internships expands because of the pandemic.
I'm sure that this has made quite an impact on parents at home trying to support all their kids in virtual learning and having to juggle working from home on top of it all.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
I'm invincible. Yeah, I win every single day. Minds are powerful. I don't need batteries to play. I'm so confident. Yeah, I'm unstoppable today. Unstoppable today.
The COVID-19 pandemic left the country without its sports teams. Fans have been watching highlights from past seasons on their couches instead of games from the stands. Dr. Amy Bass is a sports studies professor at Manhattanville College in Purchase, New York. She says certain areas of sports will take bigger hits than others.
I think that the behaviors that we see when we're not in a global pandemic are just going to be magnified in terms of women's sports. So, you know, globally, the lack of funding, the lack of support, the lack of spotlight on women's sports is just going to be exacerbated. I mean, we're already seeing, for example, in Massachusetts, the defunding of education. What are the first things to go? Oh, well, let's get rid of art and music. And I think that within a sports context, women's sports are sort of the art and music quite often, that they're considered more easily expendable. We've had this ongoing spotlight on equity that the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team has been pushing. And regardless of how you understand the legalities of their case, the ethics of their case, they have imparted an enormous amount of knowledge on just how inequity works. You know, whether it's the surface that a team is playing on, turf versus grass, or the paycheck that they're taking home. So I think during COVID-19, we're seeing some of that play out already, right? In an America that was desperate to watch something, you had an NFL draft that wasn't just televised. It was produced it was overproduced. It was overwritten. It was a show, right? And then you look at the WNBA draft, which the ratings for the NFL draft went through the roof because people just desperately wanted that sports connection, and the WNBA draft, not so much. You look at the focus on the documentary The Last Dance, moving that up so people had things to watch, and, you know, Michael Jordan, that kind of star power. Those things just aren't being done on the women's side. So I think that those are, you know, losses that are to be expected in terms of clout and spotlight. But then you look at something like Tokyo 2020 being postponed, and, you know, I'm on the skeptical side about Tokyo 2021 taking place. Amateur sports, Olympic sports, are one of the biggest stages for female athletes. And to lose that is just losing, again, that part of the spotlight that women are able to capture. U.S. women are so enormously successful in the Olympics. There's more of them there. They have a higher success rate of medals, if medals are why you're in it. So again, those global stages, as well as, you know, these burgeoning professional stages like the WNBA, and then you look at the youth level. I mean, we're already seeing the sort of development team programs cutting the girls' side. We're seeing, you know, junior leagues, same kind of thing. Who gets the money and who gets the support? This is nothing new. We're just, again, seeing it magnified.
What about equal pay? I mean, there's this fight going on. The women's soccer team lost their court battle over this. But what happens to, you know, this rise that has been, as little as it may have been, in certain women's sports? What happens now?
Well, I think that, you know, it's interesting because I'm a professor in sports studies at a Division III college, Manhattanville. And, you know, women's sports take up an enormous amount of space on our campus. Our women's volleyball team got its first NCAA tournament bid, you know, this past year. Field hockey, you know, these state championship games. So I think, again, it depends on the level that we're looking at, because equity obviously isn't just about, you know, the paychecks. But I think that one of the things that the U.S. women's soccer team has done, and they still have some pathways forward with their court case, But I think that one of the big things that they've done is they've just refuted the really tired assumptions and stereotypes that we have about the women's game. That, yes, they can sell jerseys, and yes, they can get television ratings, and yes, they do have star power, and yes, when Sue Bird and Megan Rapinoe decide to go live on Instagram, Instagram crashes, you know, that lots of these things, that these sort of tired, exhausting things that we say about women's sports just get refuted over and over again. And COVID-19 has unfortunately halted a lot of that. Like, I look at I think women's softball, you know, one of the things that ESPN had been taking closer and closer looks at because it was generating really interesting ratings demographics. Again, the WNBA. The WNBA has star power for days on its teams. And I worry about that momentum. You know, so many things are just halting, and that's the momentum that I really worry about.
Dr. Amy Bass is a professor of sports studies at Manhattanville College and an author. Her most recent book came out in 2018, One Goal, A Coach, A Team, and the Game That Brought a Divided Town Together. She's also an Emmy Award winner for her work with NBC TV at the London Olympics in 2012. A recent study from UCLA shows broad support among service members for transgender troops serving in the military. The Trump administration bans transgender people from openly enlisting as such. Emily Elena Dugdale reports from Los Angeles for the American Homefront Project.
If you get to the stop sign, you've gone too far.
Marine Judge Advocate Emma Shin directed me to her new home, a big hillside house outside of San Diego.
Hey, it's so good to meet you. Yeah, likewise.
We met before the coronavirus pandemic forced us all to keep our distance from each other. It was just after Shin moved here to serve at Camp Pendleton. Her home was filled with cardboard boxes. A new city, a new house. She says it's been a little stressful. But what hasn't been stressful is reconnecting with Marines who knew her before she transitioned in 2016.
They knew me as the old Captain Shin, right?
Now, as she reconnects with them, she says they accept her and don't treat her any differently. Shin is also the president of Sparta, a national support group for transgender service members. She recently bumped into a Marine she hadn't seen in years in the parking lot.
So I salute, and he pulls over just a little bit, and he rolls down the window, and he says, Emma, right? And he calls me over. And it was this really amazing, fantastic experience to have my name and who I am, right, validated.
A new study from UCLA shows that two-thirds of cisgender active duty military support transgender service members. That number goes up among service members who identify as women or people of color. Shin joined the service in 1994. In 2004, she was deployed to Iraq. She didn't know any other trans people in her platoon. She hadn't transitioned yet.
I'm 100% confident that if I was in that same situation today, I would be a better platoon sergeant than I was in 2004 and 2005. Being able just to be whole and to be authentic with your troops.
In 2016, President Obama allowed transgender people to serve openly in the military. But President Trump said allowing transgender people to serve would be costly and disruptive. Now, transgender people can't join the military if they've medically transitioned or been diagnosed with gender dysphoria. People like Emma Shin can stay in the military because she had enlisted before the policy change. Shannon Dunlap is a PhD student with the UCLA Department of Social Welfare, who co-wrote the study showing wide support for transgender service members. Dunlap says they found service members who identified as gay, as a woman, or a racial minority were more likely to accept transgender people in the military.
Black and Latinx service members reported the highest support for transgender people with 69% and 75% respectively.
She attributes that to their own ongoing fight for equality. The military historically has been one of the largest employers of transgender people in the country. Many of them are not serving openly. And now Dunlap says the stress of hiding their identity,
it looks like discrimination, it looks like stigma, and it's a real lack of those protections and resources that are afforded to their cisgender counterparts.
Emma Shin says the ban on open transgender service is affecting military recruitment. Potential soldiers are asking themselves questions like,
is joining worth not transitioning, right? We are losing folks from our recruiting pool in a time where recruiting is challenging.
She says the old Captain Shin lived two lives, a Marine Corps life and a private life.
And never the twain shall meet. It's like this nagging pressure, this itch that you just can't scratch that wears on you. And some days that itch may be more persistent than others, but it's there until you transition and that itch goes away.
The pressure can be too much for some service members. Shin says the military is losing talented people as a result of the Trump administration's policy. In Los Angeles, I'm Emily Elena Dugdale.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. Dr. Sharon Ufberg returns with her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews the founder of Interns for Good, Ellie Zimmerman, who will be a high school senior. She's in Westchester County, New York. Zimmerman's nonprofit provides high school students an opportunity to offer digital support to nonprofits through virtual skill-based internships. And when the COVID-19 crisis hit and students and teachers took to virtual learning, interest in virtual help with homework and tech support took off. First, Zimmerman tells Ufberg what inspired her to start Interns for Good.
I've volunteered at my local community center since I was in middle school, and I've always had a passion for giving back to my community. And in the spring of my sophomore year, I attended a semester school based in Idaho called the Azar School that's focused in leadership training and service learning. So during the portion of the semester when we go abroad, we went to a remote town in southern Chile. And we did whatever we could while we were there to help the community. And through that experience, I definitely found a new inspiration to give back and was very passionate about finding opportunities to volunteer at home. But I'm definitely very busy at home and I have a lot on my plate. I'm like president of three clubs and editor of my school yearbook and a salesperson at a local clothing store, as well as I'm on the basketball team at my school. So doing all those things and trying to keep up with all my schoolwork, I basically had no time to volunteer. And I saw all of my friends around me dealing with the same issue. They wanted to build their resumes for college, and a lot of employers aren't really willing to hire someone under 18. So then came my idea for Interns for Good, allowing high schoolers to volunteer at any time from any place. Eliminates the need for transportation, which most high schoolers don't have. Also, volunteers get valuable work experience and they can give back to worthy causes that will hopefully inspire them to become change makers in the world and continue to give back throughout their lives.
It's such a great idea. And when I looked at your site and saw that you have mobilized leadership from all around the country, can you talk about how you managed to do that? You're just one teenager in New York, yet I look and it looks like there's teens involved from all over the country.
Yeah, absolutely. So I love my leadership team, but initially I only had around 100 or 120 volunteers when I first started off, and I was receiving so many internships from nonprofits and was so overwhelmed. I was running the entire website and had to handpick interns for each job that came in based on their skills and what the nonprofit needed. So I knew that I had to reach out to my volunteers and ask them if any of them were willing to dedicate some time to helping me arrange our internships, do outreach, grow our social media, connect with volunteers, things like that. And I was so happy when 18 of them got back to me and they wrote these inspiring messages about why they wanted to join my team and make an impact in any way possible and how dedicated they were to the cause. So we began by putting into place a weekly Zoom call, and they helped me create a Slack channel, which we now communicate with each other through, and all of our volunteers multiple times a day. So each of our members of our leadership team dedicate around 5 to 10 hours a week to helping me run Interns for Good, and they have designated roles based on their skills, whether it be managing our Facebook page or connecting with nonprofits. But we all support each other to make everything happen. And we honestly have just created such great friendships with one another and such a sense of community among all of us that's really awesome and heartwarming for people from all across the country and from all different walks of life.
I'm so fascinated to hear a little bit about what kinds of projects your teams have been working on? What kinds of, you know, I know things have shifted with the COVID-19 crisis, and I want to get to that. But first, you know, initially, what kinds of projects were you being, the team being asked to do?
So we have a lot of projects, and they range from short-term projects to long-term projects based on what the nonprofit's needs are. But they're all virtual, and some of the ones that we're working on right now include like video editing for like the International Women for Women Association, website design for STEM Without Boundaries, clothing design for She's My Daughter, which is actually something that a lot of my volunteers are especially passionate about because they are creating apparel to serve as a megaphone for the silenced voices of victims of sex trafficking. And through that opportunity, they get to really harness their creativity and work on their advertising skills when they advertise the line, and they can use graphic design skills, and they give back to this really meaningful organization that does a lot of great work.
I'm sure you were knee-deep in all of this work when COVID-19 hit, and I'm so impressed of how your organization really pivoted to start helping immediately teachers and parents. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that happened, and, you know, what kinds of projects you've ended up doing now?
Yeah, so my aunt is a learning specialist and a second grade teacher at a school in Harlem, and she, when this was all going on at first, she was telling me about how the teachers at her school told her that the lesson plans they used in the classroom aren't as effective through the screen, which most of my volunteers have experienced firsthand as high schoolers during this time and have been doing virtual learning themselves. She told me that they had to quickly transition to using technology that's challenging, especially for older teachers and for parents of the students. So during this time, a lot of parents not only have to work from home, but they also have to somewhat take on the second job of teacher so that their kids can understand material like they would in their normal classrooms and keep up with all of their homework. So screens are absolutely creating a learning barrier. And I've heard from not only my aunt, but from other teachers that young students can't be expected to learn without these engaging lessons that can capture their short attention spans, and that the quality of work that young kids are producing is much less than what they would do in their traditional classrooms. So from that, I was thinking, what's next, and how can I get my volunteers involved and giving back to this cause that needs attention right now? So thanks to everything going on, having everyone stay at home, I also had a large influx of new volunteer applications. And I began getting around 40 applications a day. And so I began reaching out to the 60 or so bilingual Spanish-speaking volunteers we have. And I connected them with the ESL parents at my aunt's school in Harlem. And my volunteers created a schedule with all the times that they have available. And during those times, they can video chat with the parents who need help with technology, like Google Classroom or Zoom or whatever else they need help with. And from there, I reached out to teachers at various schools and I asked them what other topics they needed lesson plans on. So our volunteers have now created around 60 curricula, and the topics range from long division to journalism to French. And our lesson plans can be catered to certain grade levels and to different classes and courses based on what the teachers' needs are. And each of our lesson plans has not only a PowerPoint and a voiceover walkthrough of the lesson, but they also include like interactive visuals, like worksheets, and helpful videos on the topic. So to help the students get a better grip on the material, we offer like one-on-one live walkthroughs of our curriculums, but we also offer free one-on-one virtual tutoring. And so any K through eighth grade student can receive homework help or tutoring on any topic or support in a specific area that they need help in. And we currently have around 400 volunteers actively tutoring, and I'm sure that this has made quite an impact on parents at home trying to support all their kids in virtual learning and having to juggle working from home on top of it all.
So with all these volunteers doing all this unbelievable work with teachers and parents, it's summertime now. What are some of the special programs you're doing this summer?
Well, so because this summer isn't a traditional summer where a lot of kids will attend summer camps or go to their community centers, things like that, we thought that we should create our own summer opportunities. So because internships have been canceled this year, we're still continuing our virtual internships with nonprofits, and they definitely need the support to keep up their efforts in these hard times, and I'm sure that that the support from our interns is very appreciated. So we also are opening up a virtual summer camp for the students, and due to the difficulty of virtual learning that I spoke about before, the summer slide, which is typically only around 2 to 3 months each summer, has grown to be around 6 months this year, which tends to especially impact lower income families. But due to COVID-19, students of all ages and all backgrounds are falling behind in their learning, which can be very detrimental in the long run.
So what you call summer slide, when people, the learning decreases or they forget what they learned. You're calling that the summer slide. Okay.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So Interns for Good is offering a summer camp that is providing structure in the young students' days, and they're probably going crazy cooped up inside without anything to do. So it offers a little bit of structure in their days and some educational opportunities that are engaging and fun. And we're focusing on project-based learning. And so with each lesson, students will interact with their learning through activities and projects that will help them really get a better grip on the material.
It sounds very needed. And I think, you know, parents and teachers, I'm sure, have been so delighted with your help. I'm wondering if you could just tell parents and teachers that are listening, how did they find a volunteer? How did they get to you?
Yeah, so on our website, which is internsforgood.org with the number 4, we have a Google form for teachers or parents to fill out to request tech support, and a separate one for custom lesson plans, and a separate one for a virtual tutor for their student. And so on our homepage, it's designated with text that says, find a virtual tutor for your student, request a custom curriculum, fill out this for tech support. And once they fill out these forms, we then pair them up with one of our volunteers with the request based on the skills needed and the skills that our volunteers can provide.
Thank you. I think you're going to be getting a lot of people needing and wanting help this summer. I know in light of the current events that you're feeling very personally passionate about supporting nonprofits that specifically work to combat social inequality. Can you talk a little bit about how those nonprofits perhaps can reach out to you? Is it the same? Is it just on your website? Do you have any specific volunteers that are looking to lend a hand to these issues?
So we have an entire group, around 70 volunteers who are driving our Black Lives Matter volunteer opportunities. So a lot of them are working right now to reach out to nonprofits that are working towards in the fight to for the Black Lives Matter movement and in the fight against systemic racism. And so we have a whole team of them working to create art to send to these organizations, working to come up with apparel that they can sell with their designs on them and donate the profits to these organizations, as well as like reaching out to local politicians and sharing all that they're doing and the content that they come up with these politicians, so that hopefully they can leverage their publicity and share them even further to raise awareness about the cause and to inspire others to do the same. So our nonprofits can connect with them through our website. They can post any job listings that they need volunteers for on our website through a Google form. And one of our, like, over 1,000 volunteers are definitely ready, willing, and able to help them, and we'll send them based on their skills and their interests.
Ellie, thank you so much for being such an inspiration, for really galvanizing hundreds of volunteers who are eager to help. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. By the way, the summer camp was set to launch at the end of June and run through the summer in 2-week modules.
This is Bird Note. The common potu, a nocturnal bird of tropical Central and South America. What does musician Nancy Rumble, who composed the theme music for Bird Note, hear in the call of the common potu?
Well, I think that birds are like natural musicians, that when we hear their songs, immediately we do want to respond.
Using the same pentatonic scale, she responds with her ocarina. Here she adds piano.
Often I will make sketches before I will create a longer composition. So perhaps the common potu song might someday develop itself into a longer piece of music.
To hear more, come to birdnote.org.
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1614.